and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Welcome to the recording of the PhD Midwives Education Session held on February 25th, 2021, called Anthropology for Midwives by Dr. Cassandra Yule, Centre for Maternal and Child Health Research, the University of London. On the podcast homepage, you'll find a list of all the references that she included within her presentation. Please feel free to continue the conversation on Twitter.
I think we'll kick off then. I'm sure we'll have a few people joining us over the next couple of minutes. But welcome to today's PhD Midwives virtual meetup. Welcome to those who are PhD students, who are already PhD awardees, and those who in the wider community who are interested in today's webinar. Just a couple of housekeeping things to mention. If it's okay to make sure that your mics are off, that would be really helpful. And we were really hoping that we'd be able to engage with each other using the chat function, but unfortunately we have a technical hitch. So you can message Liz, and then Liz will happily share messages with the wider group. So do feel free to use the chat function throughout the afternoon. Please do tweet about today's session. You can use hashtag PhD Midwives for that. And what we're going to be, the format of the next hour and a half will be that we'll have a presentation for about 45 minutes, and then we'll have about 45 minutes free for Q&As. So do use, again, use the chat function as and when questions come to mind throughout the presentation, and we'll get to those afterwards. Okay, so without any further ado, I will, I'm really delighted to introduce Dr. Cassandra Yule. Dr. Yule is a medical anthropologist who specialises in maternal health and maternity services in the United Kingdom. Her interests cover a range of reproductive health topics with a particular focus on decision making about maternity care, informed choice and embodiment. She has conducted research on adolescent nutrition and physical activity, parent-infant sleep, place of birth, and midwifery-led care. And she is currently undertaking research on induction of labour with the CHOICE study. So without further ado, I shall hand over to Dr. Yule.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Esther. Thank you so much, Liz, for having me. Hello to everyone. Yeah, I'm really pleased to be here and to chat with you about this today. So just first, gonna get myself situated. Right, so I mean, this is just a blank slide just to say hello as well. Just a little bit about me. And first, I just also wanted to just for like accessibility purposes, just to describe myself. Yes, my name is Cassandra Yule. I'm a medical anthropologist. I'm a white woman with medium length brown hair. I'm wearing a gray dress and cream colored sweater and glasses. Okay. So yes, I do medical anthropology. I specialize in maternity services. Yeah, I'm just going to talk a little bit today about, anthropology for midwives. We're going to go through a little bit about, first of all, what anthropology is, look at some of the methodology around anthropology, look at anthropology of reproduction, as well as, and then think about, applying this in midwifery. I'm going to take a pretty lax approach. I mean, we're going to cover some, We're going to cover some, you know, obviously serious topics and serious discussions, but try to keep it a little bit, you know, informal and lighthearted. I feel like I should preface this by saying that, you know, this is my view about, you know, what anthropology can offer midwifery. My background is specifically in anthropology. I've done it, you know, from my bachelor's degree up into my PhD. I'm not a midwife by background. So this is just sort of my interpretation about from working, you know, with midwives, with healthcare professionals over the past few years. And yeah, I think it would be really great to have in the discussion, you know, what actually you think as midwives and as researchers, what, you know, what you can gain from anthropology or if I've missed something. So that's just to say that. And if I have any technical issues or if I'm not coming in or anything, just let me know, Esther. So I hope it's the sound is all okay and everything. Okay, great. I'm just going to jump in then. So this is the AIMS. I'm going to kind of go through four parts. The first thing I'd like to talk about is what is anthropology? So anthropology is the study of what makes us human. Anthropologists take a broad approach to understanding the many different aspects of human experience, which we call holism. That's from the American Anthropological Association. This is, you know, could be the past, so human origins and archaeology in particular. Looks at this a lot, and present, biological bodies, genetics, relationships with animals, ways of life, social relationships, communication, and then also complex issues like, you know, economics, law, health, policy, states, governments. So it's really everything to do with human life, really, and human experience. This is sort of thinking about like the building blocks of anthropology. So, I mean, sort of, I think like to think about this visually. So it's a holistic approach, like I said, to understanding the different aspects of human experience. You know, anthropology, what it is, it unpacks disciplines, including anthropology itself, and discourses to sort of pick apart knowledge and how it's presented. So I like to think of it as a sort of like wall of like yellow Legos, essentially. And, you know, you sort of are faced with, you know, a phenomenon or a way of life, or, you know, typically what used to be was cultures or societies or groups of people. And you sort of break that down into, over the process of doing anthropology, to many different little pieces. And then there are certain tools that you use to basically put it back together again. And so there's obviously this holistic approach. Sorry, I forgot I had animations here. So yeah, like I said, it's concerned with humans across all times and places, taking into account the many different dimensions of humanity. There's also this aspect of reflexivity within anthropology. So this is the researcher's constant analysis of their values, views, and emotions within the field, reflecting on how these can influence their relationship and participants and to their relationships to participants and their research. There's also this idea of positionality. And so this matters because this matters who you are and you're in this influences your research. And your role is constantly being negotiated during research. And obviously, finally, like a lot of other research, you know, critical thinking and engagement is another key part of that. And this is sort of the things that we use to unpack and then, you know, through this, put something back together again, essentially. And I shared this picture of Donna Haraway. She's a pretty well-known feminist anthropologist, social scientist. And I feel like this picture makes me feel like what doing anthropology makes me feel like. It's a little bit strange. It's a little bit like weird. It's a little bit all over the place. And, you know, there's a lot of different elements involved in it.
Slides are not moving.
Oh, they're not moving.
No, not for the view that we've got. We're still on the title.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
I can see them okay, strangely.
Can you? Okay. Good. No worries. I'll yeah. Cut my end.
How is it for everyone else?
I can see them. It's moving just fine for me.
Yeah, they're moving fine for me.
Sorry. Ignore me.
Well, do let me know because, yeah, the chat, I don't know if it's popping up in the chat.
No, it's working.
Okay. All right. Great. Excellent. Right. So, yeah, I think, you know, in terms of like thinking anthropologically, it's thinking, I guess, about spaces, places, states, technologies, bodies, expression, and also health and institutions. You know, initially, there's a famous anthropologist, or, you know, long gone now, or sort of early, Ruth Benedict, she's an American anthropologist, said that the sort of goal of anthropology is to make the world safe for human differences. So, just gonna move, sorry, move it forward. I'm going on two screens here, so excuse me. So there's different subfields within anthropology. You have social anthropology, biological anthropology, medical anthropology. There's also linguistic anthropology as well. I'm not going to touch on that one as much. And also, depending on where you are, archaeology too as well. I did my undergraduate degree in the US, so they actually include archaeology in anthropology, but that's not the same in the UK. So social anthropology seeks to understand the internal logic of societies through ethnography. Biological anthropology is focused on humans, non-humans, primates, past and present, for ecological and evolutionary purposes. And this is looking at the intersection of behavior, culture, and biology, and how these systems impact health and well-being. And the medical anthropology is what I do, seeks to better understand the factors that influence people's health and well-being. Medical anthropology itself, which is, I think, what, you know, what we're going to be touching on the most here today, is only emerged in the 1950s. And always has had a very much of applied orientation, and is also concerned with understanding and responding to the pressing health issues and problems around the world as they are influenced and shaped by human social organization, culture, and context. So anthropology traditionally, the anthropologists would work in communities and areas that are very different from their own. And over the past few decades, this has kind of changed, so a lot more anthropologists do anthropology at home. But it is really good to know sort of within the history of anthropology, which is really what I think is also very important, because the history of anthropology as a discipline, you know, really impacts, you know, the type of methodology that we have when I'm talking about ethnography. It's sort of all sort of woven together. So I do really want to focus on that too as well. In this talk. So there's also some other subfields too as well. We have feminist anthropology, and this is concerned with women's reproductive experiences. This is just about women's lives, not just women's reproductive experiences, about everything. But yeah, this considers, you know, gender. It also, feminist anthropology, you know, came about as women started to enter the field discipline a lot more. And so there was always this sort of, you know, male bias, a man's bias, you know, within anthropology, that, you know, feminist anthropology was really important for critiquing. And so, you know, women's reproductive health, or, you know, and, you know, pregnancy and birth, really studies, you know, that started, anthropological studies started to enter into the sort of anthropological canon and, you know, literature a lot more once women started to enter into the discipline. So that's also really important in the formation of anthropology of reproduction. Also, I wanted to touch on critical medical anthropology. And so this also merges political economic approaches with anthropological methods. It also has a very strong applied orientation because it is medical anthropology, and a commitment to improving population health and promoting health equality. This sort of critical approach to medical anthropology is also quite a new development, sort of developed in the 1980s. And this was looking at, you know, not just people's health or their experiences of suffering in particular, but also looking at, you know, how these experiences were shaped by, you know, social and political life. And so this is sort of looking at these, these everyday experiences of health and sort of connecting them with the wider sort of macro structures within a society, within a culture, even sort of globally. And I think that this is particularly critical medical anthropology. It's sort of a framework I work within myself, but also I think is a really interesting framework and perhaps a useful framework for midwives. So I also just wanted to say quickly as well, a little bit about decolonizing anthropology, talking about epistemology, methodology, and community in particular. I think it's really important when we're talking about anthropology, when we're talking about ethnography, that we recognize and acknowledge the fact that anthropology emerged from colonial expansion from Europe. Colonialism, structured, this is a quote, structured the relationship between anthropologists and the people they studied and had an effect on the methodological and conceptual formulations in the discipline. For example, the role of the objective observer. It has a professional exploitation aspect to it, and can be viewed as an academic manifestation of colonialism. So this is a picture of Bronislaw Malinowski. He is a very famous anthropologist who took anthropology, quote unquote, from the armchair. So initially anthropologists were doing a lot of comparative studies, looking at this idea of, how culture evolved basically from, areas of the world that were non-Western, particularly, into the ideal culture, which was Western culture, particularly European culture, and taking this and, bringing anthropology into, the actual on-the-ground field work. And so he's really well known for developing the ideas of, the way that we do ethnography nowadays, not entirely, but it does shape that. And, the idea that you can just go into a space, can go into a community, and, that you're not necessarily invited into that community, and then you can take knowledge away and then use it, and repurpose it or represent it and write about it, for your own career, has, implications and also political implications and is very colonial in its in the way it's done. And so a really important aspect of, anthropology and what we're doing is, this is an ongoing project. This is something that I'm certainly working on myself within my work because, when we are taught anthropology, the type of literature that we're taught from, the type of things that are stressed, the type of the canon that we're taught from, stresses certain people's knowledge over others. And so I sort of point to, like I said, this is an ongoing project. And I think this is as well, I wanted to highlight this because, I think that looking at, the epistemology, the methodology, and the relationships that you have to communities is also something that is really relevant for all researchers and for midwifery as well. So, thinking about for instance, epistemology, so this is looking at how anthropological knowledge is produced and shaped. And this is, looking at, trying to understand what is known. The issue with anthropology is that, within knowledge systems, these ideas, colonial knowledge is reiterated within knowledge systems. And so, in trying to, decolonize the discipline, it's really realigning what research is important. Like I said, sort of, decolonizing the canon. We're looking at, whose knowledge matters. It's also about, citations too as well. Citations are not, the end all be all of this, but looking at, who we are citing. For instance, Malinowski is, highly cited and highly referenced, when you learn about anthropology, for instance. And also this is about rethinking methodology. I think a lot of work has been done with this as well. And so this is thinking about, power and status that we gain from institutions and how we embody these during our research and in our field work, in our relationships in the field. Is manifest into research questions about teaching and working with communities, and or so how does this manifest, within you know, teaching and working with communities, and as well thinking about communities, you know, who are the communities within which the research is being done, and thinking about our own community as anthropologists and doing research, you know, within a community. This is the idea of, you know, being invited. I went to a talk recently about decolonizing methodology within anthropology, and there was this idea of, you know, being invited, I think is really important. And so, yeah, like I said, you know, this is something to think about, not just within anthropology, but also more generally as researchers. And also, you know, my discussion of ethnography, what is ethnography? I'm going to sort of touch on some of these things too, as well, and sort of bring it back. So I did want to mention that. I mean, ethnography, you know, some people say writing culture, a portion of people, the recording and analysis of a culture or society, usually based on participant observation and resulting in a written account of people, place, or institution. I think that's a nice definition of it. You know, for a lot of people, ethnographic fieldwork defines anthropology, and you know, ethnography is a lot of things, and we're going to get into that because I'm going to, you know, present you with this sort of, you know, on the face sort of thing of what ethnography is. It is the driving methodology of anthropology. And it's, sorry, I am an anthropologist and we write down a lot and we read a lot from stuff. So if you see me looking over at my notes, that is why. yeah, I mean, ethnography is typically, you know, ethnographic fieldwork is, you know, it's typically long. It lasts usually for about a year at least. And anthropologists tend to go back to where they study for decades. Anthropologists have written a lot about ethnography, so I'm just going to try to highlight what I can. And yeah, I think, you know, ethnography is a methodology that's always in flux. You know, there's been a lot of developments since the days of Malinowski, for instance. Obviously, we're, you know, doing anthropology at home a lot more now. It's not just going into people's spaces and, you know, taking whatever knowledge that, you know, we want from them and, you know, sort of, you know, sort of re-representing it as, you know, sort of our own and our own standards. So in that sense, you know, this is sort of a methodology that is developing all the time, which is really good. You know, you want that. so yeah, just, I think, you know, it's obviously a methodology, and it involves, you know, this idea of participant observation. It can also be interviews. It sort of is building what would be a holistic account of a community, of a group of people, of a society. Traditionally, it was a culture. And also what's really important about ethnography is the written aspect of it. You know, so it's an idea of sort of, you know, creating this, a portrait of people, except, you know, you do it with words. And yeah, I think, sort of move on from that because I'm aware of time. I could go into that a lot more. Probably just sort of fast forward right to participant observation. Yeah, so participant observation is sort of the one main method within, or I guess traditionally a main method within ethnography. It's, you know, open-ended, inductive, long-term. Like I said, fieldwork can be a very, very long time. It's the whole goal of participant observation is to understand local knowledge, values, and practices from the insider's point of view, and contextualize these insights and show how these are also meaningful ways to live life. I mean, you know, this whole idea of, you know, looking at communities that people had no idea about and basically documenting them. And that was sort of the initial impetus for, you know, doing this type of work and why people were doing this. And the way that you do this is not just through observation. You also have to be a part of that, you know, community to get that insider knowledge. You have to participate. So initially, There used to be a lot of anthropologists who were these sort of armchair anthropologists. You know, doing observations was really important because in terms of, you know, scientific inquiry and doing empirical research, observations are, you know, one of the driving methods of that. And this means that there was a lot of detachment, though. And so being on the ground and being a participant means that enables you to get that insider knowledge. Participant observation is arguably what distinguishes anthropology from other disciplines, particularly sociology. But I think, you know, those disciplinary boundaries are really merging and really like not necessarily distinct anymore. But anthropologists, you know, don't just necessarily use participant observation to do ethnography. There's a lot of people do focus groups, audio, visual, textual sources, interviews as well to build their studies. So participant observation is really seen though still as a core method. And it's supposed to be, you know, the whole point of it is to provide this really holistic and, you know, profound understanding, which is also why it needs to be so long-term. I think, you know, this is obviously changed a lot, you know, initially too as well. Anthropology was done in other, you know, communities, and now it's done a lot at home, or sort of in the countries where people come from. But like, we're going to take ethnography. It seems so lovely, you know, looking at these complex, you know, interactions and ways of life and, documenting them. We're just going to, you know, problematize it because I'm an anthropologist and that's what we do. So, as I like these memes, sorry, I'm trying to keep it a little bit interesting here at the end of the day. It's true. One does not simply just do ethnography. You know, there's like a lot of things, you know, yes, of course, you can just go into a community, but and you can participate. And like, what does that mean? Like, what does that entail? Like, what are the problems? Like we said, you know, these sort of looking at this colonial history, like, what are the issues there? Like, you know, how I think that, you know, there's a lot of issues as well, you know, how much do you participate? How much do you observe? You know, this balance between, you know, how much of this is actually giving you an insider look. I also had a quote a little while back of this idea of, you know, Clifford Geertz is an anthropologist, and this idea of, you know, deep hanging out. You know, it's like a lot of anthropologists talk about their field work and they're like, I'm just going and we're hanging out. Like, that's what we do. We're hanging around. And you know, deep hanging out is very much predicated on being there and being a part, you know, it's observing and it's long-term sort of intensive observation within a group of people. And that sort of, you know, can give you, a certain a certain view into people's lives, but also, you know, there are certain issues with, you know, you being there and being within that place. So, obviously, initially when people were doing ethnography, when they were doing participant observation, it was really important to be a detached, to have detached involvement. And so, you know, in Malinowski's days, it was seen as, you know, scientifically rigorous. You know, anthropology was trying very hard to be a science. I think we are still trying hard to be, you know, something, but maybe not necessarily like a hard science in the sort of traditional sense. But, you know, having some distance from the people who you were studying was seen as scientific rigor. And so, around, you know, the 1960s, 70s, you know, the sort of taking these sort of postmodern turns, there was a rejection of this detachment within anthropology and doing ethnography. And so this is important that, you know, you're making your positionality, and I talked about this, you know, who you are, making that visible. And that was supposed to be, you know, so for instance, for me, in terms of my positionality, I'm a white woman, I'm from the US, I'm middle class. And, you know, that position affects, you know, the way I do my research, the way, you know, the way I interact with knowledge, the way I, you know, interact with spaces, or the way I am within a space, you know, and how I take up space too as well. And so this is this idea of this position subject, which is a quote from Renato Rosaldo. It's that the position subject is not a blank slate, and that the objects of social analysis are also analyzing subjects whose perceptions must be taken as seriously as we take our own. And it also recognizes that you are somebody. You come out of a certain class, you come out of a certain place, you go into a certain country, and then you go home and you do all of these things. So this is another really, I think, and this is another thing that, you know, I think that this is not necessarily an anthropological thing. I think that this is also, you know, important for doing research in general. Another part of this is really connected to this idea of positionality. Sort of recognizing positionality allows you to be reflexive. And so this reflexive turn is sort of also connected to this idea of positionality. And it considers the production of knowledge and how we create these portraits of people, you know? So obviously part of being detached and involved was, you know, not putting yourself in the text at all. And obviously when you sort of recognize your positionality, you know, realizing that you also have a subjectivity, and that's equally important too, as well. You know, it's then sort of leads to sort of, you know, putting yourself in this text. I mean, writing is in anthropology is so important, which I'm going to sort of come to later. But yes, this sort of idea of being reflexive is sort of an acknowledgement too, as well, that, you know, we change roles when we're doing participant observation, when we're doing research. You know, we move from being a researcher or, you know, the participant within a community. When I was doing my PhD field work, you know, being a volunteer in, you know, the East London community, and then moving back to being, you know, a PhD researcher. And this is not smooth. And this is, you know, this can be very messy. And so, you know, the acknowledgement, you know, sort of working through that reflexively is sort of an acknowledgement that, you know, fieldwork is like relational, intersubjective, and also often emotionally charged. And I really like that because I think that that is, you know, really true. And it sort of also counters this idea that there is this distance between the researcher and the researched. Obviously, it's, of course, so messy and doesn't necessarily close that gap. If you are interested in more about this, I know Pierre Baudière wrote a lot about that too, as well, about this idea that this reflexivity is supposed to close this gap, this distance between, you know, the knower and the known. Moving right along. Ethnographic entanglements. Like I said, I'm going to problematize it. So, you know, we are also reflexive about, you know, not just the type of work that we do. We're also, you know, reflexive as well about our own discipline's biases. You know, we, particularly when we're working interdisciplinarily, you know, this is really important about how we talk about our research, how we present ourselves, how we present our knowledge. So this reflexivity works both ways. And so when, you know, you're sort of being reflexive about your own discipline's, you know, ways of doing things, that sort of leads you to really becoming, really gazing inward, I think, on, you know, what doing ethnography even means. So I mentioned anthropology at home. Also this idea of, if, you know, bounded versus unbounded fields. You know, as I was saying, traditionally with doing ethnography, it was going into, you know, particularly probably a very small, sometimes very isolated community that was, you know, living in a very sort of set boundary within a group, you know, in usually another country. And, you know, that doing anthropology at home in particular, like I did, you know, my research in East London, of course, there is a boundary if you look at a map, but, you know, really East London is, you know, it is not a small bounded community somewhere. It is a huge, you know, sort of urban space, and, you know, people don't necessarily fit into the sort of boundaries within that space. And so sort of looking at, you know, what it means and where it means to do anthropology is sort of looking at that really open setup. I could probably talk about this way too much because I did go into this a lot in my thesis, but there's also issues with, you know, and I'm more than happy to talk about this more. There's also issues of sort of breaking people up into these, you know, manageable spaces, you know. It almost seems like, you know, seeing people, you know, focus on these bounded spaces really sort of places people as objects of analysis, and, you know, can also be sort of really connected to, you know, why do anthropologists feel so comfortable in these bounded spaces? Is that sort of, you know, another one of these connections to, you know, the sort of colonial legacies in which you sort of are able to take people as units of analysis, essentially. And, you know, you have methodological and epistemological control when you're working within that bounded space, and that being very, you know, comfortable for anthropologists. And, you know, I know arguably, you know, this could also be where we can control the knowledge so we can uncover what we feel like we already know. And so, you know, sort of disrupting these ideas of, you know, where should anthropology, or excuse me, ethnography is traditionally done. Also, you know, sort of looks at, you know, what we stress to as well. And, you know, this idea of looking at ethnography as engaged listening. There's a lot of, you know, stress put on what is seen, but also, you know, but not necessarily what so much as what is heard. And so there's a lot of more sort of sensorial anthropology that started to develop. And yeah, I'm just going to continue moving. There's just different forms of you know, ethnography that it might be useful for you. I'm not sure, you know, how many people are using ethnography here. So, you know, we've got critical ethnography, which is, you know, explicitly sets out to critique hegemony, oppression, and asymmetrical power relations in order to foster social change. And there's also, you know, digital ethnography now. You know, we're talking about, you know, a really unbounded space within these digital spheres. And this is, you know, the field site can be, you know, comprised of, you know, text, video, images, and really looking at, you know, really often multinational communities that sort of come together and sometimes, you know, really impermanent groupings, or, you know, having these sort of really interesting relationships, you know, within digital spaces. And that's also always very interesting and obviously very relevant nowadays, you know, when we have to really rethink, you know, how we're doing ethnography, particularly when you can't necessarily do participant observation, you know, face-to-face. You could definitely do it online. But yeah, doing things like, you know, within MomsNet, I think is a really great example of, you know, one of those digital spaces and those digital communities. There's also hospital ethnography. I mean, obviously the hospital is definitely another one of those sort of bounded spaces, but this is really interesting to sort of, you know, look at the hospital as an institution too as well. And this type of work hasn't really, you know, taken off until the early 2000s, but really focusing on, you know, the nature and the function of the hospital too as well. It's sort of this site, this sort of premier site of biomedical knowledge. And, you know, obviously being midwives, particularly, I don't know where everyone is working from, but particularly probably working in, you know, Europe and the US, you know, biomedical knowledge is very highly concentrated in these areas. And then autoethnography is another form of ethnography. And this one I don't know too much about, but I know it's been emerging, and I figured I'd, you know, sort of highlight it, given that, you know, how much is changing from COVID nowadays. But this is sort of much more of a very literary and poetic way of, you know, doing ethnography. It's sort of looking at research and writing and method that's connected to autobiographical and personal, that's sort of connected to the autobiographical and personal, and how it's connected to the social and cultural. And so it's sort of looking at, you know, action, emotion, embodiment, self-consciousness, and introspection, and how sort of culture holds all these together. Right. So also just a quick note to say that, you know, ethnography is a methodology, participant observation is a method, you know, in sort of thinking about the difference between, you know, observation versus participant observation. I've sort of mentioned a lot about, you know, the stress on, you know, what is seen. And I really like this quote by Donna Haraway, you know, vision is always it's always a question of the power to see. And she's got this really interesting theory called the God's eye trick, God trick, which is essentially, it's mainly about science. And it's critiquing, objectivity. And I think, a lot of what we consider, observation is really based around this idea of objectivity. Being able to see, all that's going on within a space at once and being able to, generate truth from that. And, this is not, it's they say the God's eye trick because, it's under the guise of neutrality, of being able to see all, of being objective. This is a very specific view, it's obviously within a scientific view, traditionally white, male, heterosexual, and Donna Haraway would also say human. And this position under the guise of neutrality, obscures and delegitimizes other forms of knowledge, other subjectivities, other views, denies people voice and subjectivity and presence. And so I think it's really important to think about that, when we are observing things, when we are doing our research, what kind of view are we taking, and what are we allowing space for? So yeah, I just wanted to sort of mention that too as well. And then also analysis. where to begin? Analysis in anthropology is, for me, I think it's really like felt out work, but it's, holistic, comparative, temporal, relational, obviously reflexive. It's, it's cyclical, but it's also a lot about, representation. I just came across this tweet the other day, yesterday or 2 days ago. Sorry, I don't remember what day it is, clearly. is that, ethnography requires an extraordinary investment of time. The deep engagement with sites and subjects extends to meticulous and laborious reading and ordering of notes, records, ephemera, slowly reveals structures and silences. And if you don't do it, you might not appreciate the rigor. So, obviously, like I was saying, is that, doing ethnography is not just about participant observation. It's not just about observing. There's a lot of things that, are involved with it. Whether it's interviews, whether it's, images or texts or, archives that you're, bringing together to sort of create this holistic picture. And, I think this also brings me to, the idea, the analysis and the writing. We have more ethnographic entanglements, and I think this is really relevant for people doing their PhDs, for any researcher anywhere, about the writing, about that part. Because eventually, we all have to, especially for PhD students, we have to write the thesis. And, when you're doing research, with people, you're representing them, within your text. And a big part of that is sort of working through that representation, working through, how you're representing yourself. This is a really interesting, I think, topic as well, this idea of, making the other within anthropology. Presenting people within a text to whether or not they actually have a presence. You're trying to capture that presence. You're basically, so this is the, the Fabian, reference that I'm mainly talking about here when I'm talking about this. And it's a really interesting, discussion about this, that, you're bringing the then to the now, you're bringing the there to the here. Obviously, that's not necessarily the case. It used to be, obviously, if someone was doing, research in another country, but they were very, very much bringing, somewhere else to where you are, situated. And how do you do that? How do you do that in a way that, gives people presence? Obviously if people were there, or, where you could bring them and actually have presence, you wouldn't have to represent them. And it's sort of critically looking at, how people are represented. There's a lot of issues. Obviously this is, sort of stems back as well, and sort of has, it's sort of rooted in the sort of colonial legacy too, as well, of anthropology about representation, about the idea of, the fact that, ethnography to a certain extent, was about the exotic, about things that, in other places and other people that, people have never heard of before. How to sort of break that down and like make it, people to have a presence within the text. I think sometimes we're still working through this. So I definitely don't, you know, have, you know, the answers to this one. But I think, you know, Fabian pointed out that, you know, if we are trying to make our writing critically useful for the communities that we write about, does this mean that the people that we've studied would profit from reading those writings, that the conventions of anthropology publishing or another disciplines publishing have qualified as acceptable ethnography? So, you know, thinking about writing in a way that, you know, is not just for you, is not just for anthropology or whoever else or for the, academia, but also writing for the people that, you know, you've done the research with, and how we sort of, you know, this comes into dissemination too as well. You know, there's definitely in anthropology a way of writing that cannot, that's not always accessible. And, you know, I think it's a really good question that, you know, whether or not there can be an anthropology without ethnography, what it means to sort of detach those two things. You know, what kind of things that anthropology has to offer outside of ethnography. So, you know, I think, you know, maybe these are things maybe we can chat about more because I am aware of the time and I've just seen it. I'm getting way too into ethnography right now. But yeah, we'll move on. Probably some things to talk about in the chat. You know, so basically I think, you know, it's really important to also look at, you know, what has anthropology offered in terms of, you know, outside of, not necessarily outside of ethnography, but, you know, what are some of the things that have been produced from doing this type of work, particularly in the scope of reproduction? So a big part of, you know, doing anthropology of reproduction, particularly critical medical anthropology, is interrogating this idea of this concept and the structure of biomedicine. And so biomedicine obviously is the predominant medical theory and practice, you know, that we all know, that's been widely disseminated throughout the world. And so anthropology of reproduction has been very, very, I think, really good about, you know, in terms of, you know, encountering this and interrogating it and criticizing it, and how this is affecting, you know, people's lives, when it comes to reproduction, pregnancy, and birth. Just quickly, so what are these things that I think, you know, this idea of authoritative knowledge, particularly looking at, you know, biomedicine as a form of authoritative knowledge. It's obviously not necessarily just constrained to that. There's a lot of uses for the concept of authoritative knowledge, but, you know, this is a system that, you know, devalues alternative, you know, knowledge systems. When we're thinking again about that, this idea of the God trick, for instance, you know, this idea of, you know, there, it not, things not having legitimacy, and this being a self, almost sort of, excuse me, this being a process that is sort of reiterated over and over again. It's the fact, it's about, you know, the knowledge that counts, but is not necessarily correct or accurate. So I think the good examples of this is, and I think as well as authoritative knowledge, you know, looking at these different knowledge systems is seeing how, you know, sometimes this authoritative knowledge system really kind of comes into conflict with, you know, how people live their lives. And so Emily Martin's work is really looks at this, the woman in the body, is sort of the differences between medical descriptions of women's reproduction, for instance, or reproductive health, and the way that it is actually experienced by people. So she looked at particularly how, this is in American culture, how medical textbooks described things, reproductive processes, particularly, you know, labor is managed, menstruation is viewed as a failed reproduction, but also, you know, the uterus is a voluntary muscle that women don't have control over. It's a lot of mechanical metaphors, but when she actually, you know, she went through all these textbooks, you know, really looked at this idea of, you know, a woman's body being sort of seen as, you know, this this robot, this factory, this mechanical device. But then when she did her field work or her, you know, participant observation with women, you know, they often did not conceive of their bodies this way. They didn't, you know, use these types of metaphors. And there was, to a certain extent, some resistance too, as well, to these. And yeah, I think it's just, you know, many different visions of life are different for different women. Another thing, sorry, I'm aware of the time. also this idea of, you know, the political aspect of reproduction too, as well. And this is sort of focusing on, you know, so the quotes there. So the intersecting interests of states and other powerful institutions as multinational and national corporations, international development agencies, Western medicine, religious groups, and how they construct the context within which local reproductive relationships are played out. And this is this review is really good if anyone's looking for a good overview. Even though it was published in 1991, I think it's really still relevant. And it's, I think, you know, in sort of thinking about how the political economy around reproduction sort of plays out and is an experience too as well. And I think some good examples of this is this idea of stratified reproduction, the ways in which, you know, not just reproductive labor, but reproductive experiences, I think, in general, are experienced differently according to inequalities that are based on hierarchies, race, class, gender, ethnicity, and place within the global economy and migration status, and are structured by social, economic, and political forces. I was thinking about this in terms of, you know, the NHS fees for, you know, reproductive health care, and migration status and asylum seekers, and, you know, how some, you know, people who are migrants, who are asylum seekers, you know, are not able to access care because of these fees and delay care, or their care seeking, you know, based on these fees. You know, so that's an idea, you know, of you know, stratified reproduction. As well, you know, in terms of, you know, midwifery too as well, and this idea of the body politic. So, you know, anthropologists have looked at midwifery, not just reproduction. So this book by Gertrude Fraser looks at birth, race, and midwifery in the United States, particularly the South. And I think this is a really good example of ethnographic representation about how you can, you know, use fieldwork as well as, you know, public health narratives, archives, documents, a lot of different sources, and bring it together to, you know, essentially tell a story. And this was looking at particularly how African-American midwives were pushed out of providing pregnancy and birth care to poor women, rural women living in Virginia, African-American, and poor white women too as well, and basically gradually pushed out of this reproductive health care by public health workers, doctors, and state legislators, and the different ways that this was done, whether it was through, you know, birth certificate registration, also birth certificate registration, and I think as well sort of the certification, that's the word I'm looking for, certification too as well, and sort of, you know, certification of midwifery and sort of formalization of midwifery too as well, and essentially using these tools to, blame infant mortality rates on midwives as a tool of, you know, pushing them out of practice. So those are just some of the ways that, you know, anthropology, I think, has been used, particularly in a sort of political, historical sense, within reproduction and reproductive health and history. Anyway, so just to sort of wrap up, as I realize I'm going over time, I think this is important. This is basically just to say that, you know, body, society, and culture and health are really interconnected. And that, you know, reproductive health is included in this, obviously. And midwifery as a profession and a practice, praxis is situated within this nexus. And anthropology provides a theory and concepts for thinking about these intersections. And ethnography is a methodology that can provide support when researching at these intersections. You know, the formation, health is, you know, very much involved with the formation of identity and subjectivity. You know, I think these questions are, you know, really relevant. You know, what particularly political, historical, technological, and cultural circumstances facilitate, shape, and constrain the working of health identities? How and when do specific situated concerns move some social actors, but not others, to think and act in terms of health? And what resources are at stake? So I think that, you know, thinking about these things and the fact that, you know, anthropology provides, you know, really good tools to think about all of these sort of very complicated intersecting, you know, phenomena and structures as well. And also for midwifery in particular, you know, midwifery, I mean, I'm not a midwife. This is just my interpretation, though. So some of you might differ from, but, you know, as a profession, midwifery acknowledges its commitment to the health outcomes for women and children. And so this is an inherently, you know, political profession. And, you know, is, you know, according to this author, you know, involved in the politics of normalizing birth. And there's, you know, when a lot of that, you know, within anthropology of reproduction is really, you know, that part of critiquing biomedicine has been about, you know, this humanization of birth. And midwifery is really, you know, an important part of that, obviously. And yeah, midwifery as a discipline is consequently well-placed to examine and document the power dynamics of birth. And, you know, this is an article about, you know, applying critical medical anthropology framework to midwifery research. And that's to wrap up, because I can see I'm almost out of time. I guess I just, you know, I know I'm talking to a lot of PhD students. So I just wanted to say, on generally on doing research for ages, I feel like I don't know what I'm doing or why. I drive my family nuts, wandering around clueless, but I just have this conviction that if I keep going, something will fall into place. And I think that that is really true with a lot of research, with doing the PhD, probably with my own talk right now, or just sort of wandering around talking about things. But, you know, yeah, I guess I'll just sort of end there. But yeah, I mean, that's just a, doing anthropology is this sort of, you know, complex process like everything else. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Cassandra. I feel like I could listen to you talk, honestly, for a lot longer. And I know you've really had to condense a really huge subject in a very short amount of time, which is quite the feat and quite the achievement. So thank you so very much. I don't know about everyone else, but I have a page of questions here. but I can see some questions coming in through the chat. And so please, we've got another half an hour. So please, if anyone else has any questions or reflections, do pop them into the chat and we'll have time to go through them. So we've got a couple that have come through already. Anna has asked, can you outline the relationship between positionality and reflexivity?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, I'm just sort of opening everything up. Yeah, I mean, I think that they're, and this is just my take on it. So I know there's been a lot written on it. So reflexivity initially was when it entered into anthropological methodology. It was, like I said, trying to, you know, bridge this distance between, you know, the relationship between the researcher and the researched. And so I think what's really implicated when you do that type of work, when you're doing that reflexive work, is who you are as the researcher. So I think, you know, you can't necessarily, you know, do reflexivity or be reflexive within your work if you can't, you know, if you're not able to acknowledge, you know, who you are and your position as the researcher. It's about sort of recognizing that, you know, and the people who you're researching, you know, they have a subjectivity, obviously they have a life, they have, you know, ways of doing things that, you know, you're trying to, you know, make sense of when you're doing the research, but also, you know, you have the same exact thing. And you're basically, by doing this research, particularly participant observation, but, you know, it's not necessarily just participant observation, it's also doing the interviews or focus groups, is that, you know, these are two things are coming together. These two views or these two, you know, people, these two groups are coming together, these two subjectivities are coming together. So that's some, this idea of this intersubjectivity. And so being able to reflect that in the text is really important. I think, yeah, the relationship is essentially that they are just both really interconnected. I don't know if you can necessarily even be reflexive without, you know, also having, you know, positionality, because, you know, if we are trying to basically look at this relationship between, you know, the researcher and the researched, then, you know, the researcher, you know, you basically have to acknowledge that and make that visible, you know, your role. I hope that answers the question. I can't really see anybody, so I'm trying to, yeah, but thank you, Anna. It's a really good question.
That's great. Thank you. Okay. Jo also posted a question and she said, what's your favorite anthropological text on the subject of the maternity system or childbirth?
So wait, what was the favorite text? Sorry, what was that again?
On the subject of the maternity system or childbirth.
Gosh. That's a really hard one. I've just read, you know, Gertrude Fraser's book finally. I think it's a real shame that I was never introduced to it as an anthropology undergraduate. I think it's a fantastic text, and I think it's, you know, one of my favorites, in terms of, you know, just the way it's written. It's really accessible. It's very, you know, it's not bogged down, I think, by the sort of anthropology language. But yeah, I really enjoyed that one. But that's just because, you know, I mean, there's probably others and I'm just totally blanking right now. But yeah.
If anything else comes to mind, feel free to pop it on Twitter and we'll read it. I'm sure there must be a lot of.
I mean, I also, she's not an anthropologist, but I also really have always really liked Rachel Chadwick's work too as well. She's a sociologist, but I really also really love reading her work too as well. I think that, you know, she writes a lot about methodology too as well. So she does a lot on the body. It was usually in South Africa is where she does her research. So I've always really enjoyed her work too as well. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. There's another question from Molly here. Can you share challenges you may have experienced with your own relationship with reflexivity during your research?
Yeah. I definitely... So I think coming into spaces as a non-healthcare professional is always really, I don't know, it was really interesting in terms of, you know, working in spaces and also trying to communicate within those spaces. There's a definite way that, you know, people talk to, communicate with one another, particularly how little people say sometimes and how quick and to the point, which I am obviously not because I'm an anthropologist and we just talk, which is like winding statements. And so I think, you know, sort of struggling with that sort of my position, also as well, you know, my own knowledge base or lack of knowledge base is always one that I'm very much aware of as being, you know, a medical anthropologist, particularly working with healthcare professionals about, you know, very specific health health experiences. You know, it's always sort of like learning on the go. You know, what does this acronym mean? What does this stand for? You know, learning all the different, you know, sort of intricate parts of the knowledge base. As well, you know, I guess just, you know, to what extent, I guess, just trying to think, you know, doing field work. I mean, maybe I haven't been reflexive enough. I mean, I had a really, you know, good experience in my PhD. I worked with a really nice group of people, and volunteered quite a lot. And, you know, it was a really good experience for me. I think it was, you know, I worked predominantly with women though. So I, you know, it's hard to know how some of these things would have changed if I was, you know, working with, in a more male dominated area. You know, so I think just sort of thinking about, you know, myself coming in as well as an outsider into these groups and inserting myself, you know, it's a negotiated relationship, and it has to be based on trust. And, you know, this researcher-research relationship, you know, there's at the beginning when you are going through those gatekeeping processes, and, you know, inserting yourself essentially into a group of people, you know, you're like, am I just, you know, you always think about like, I always think about like, what can I give back? Because I always feel like I'm like essentially taking something for my own benefit and being really aware of that, which is why I always end up, you know, doing a lot of volunteer work. And I always enjoy doing that because I think that, you know, I think it's really important to give back to the communities that, you know, you're working with. It's not just sort of entering in the space and taking, you know, what you need knowledge wise and leaving. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. Just going through, we've got a few more questions coming through here. So how can, as midwives, how can we best utilise anthropology to support the holistic delivery of midwifery research that specifically focuses on LGBT and pregnancy health and care?
Yeah, I think, I'm just going to say, I don't know. I'm looking at the question. I can see it. Thank you so much. That is a really important question. I mean, I think in general, you know, the holistic approach of anthropology is really great in this aspect. And looking at, you know, the totality of individuals and experiences and histories is really, I think, you know, really key here. I know in terms of, you know, looking at, in terms of, you know, identity, I mean, I think in terms of anthropology, I guess anthropology doesn't, you know, in terms of like, I guess identity politics doesn't, you know, question like why an identity exists essentially. It's just is sort of looking at, you know, what goes on, I guess like around that identity, you know, in terms of, you know, or around an individual. And I think that's a really important one too, as well. Obviously the sort of critical and activist sides of anthropological work, particularly, you know, something like critical medical anthropology as a framework, looking at, you know, there's a political economic side to it, of course, but also, you know, I think it's about, you know, it focuses on life histories, like I said, and how these are sometimes constrained, unfortunately. And I think that sort of understanding of, you know, how that affects, you know, particularly the LGBTQI+ community, and, you know, in providing holistic care is really important. I mean, this is just coming from me. I don't know if it's, you know, necessarily what's you know, obviously I don't provide care, but it seems like to me, from my perspective, you know, having that and, you know, recognizing that understanding or sort of having that understanding that, like, you know, health is not just, of course it's bodily. Of course there's a biological, physiological aspects to it, but health is also, you know, social too, as well. I hope that answers the question. It's a big question. I'm sure there's more we could do.
It looks like the comment was, it's very helpful, thanks. So yeah, that's great, thank you. And a couple more questions. This one actually, because a lot of us are undertaking PhDs, and those of us who aren't anthropologists by background, some are, some aren't. For those of us who aren't, who are going to be, one of the things I've certainly found is I'm increasingly reading ethnographic papers. I think it offers anthropologically sort of framed papers, which offer such a nuanced take and nuanced perspectives that sometimes in the biomedical literature is lacking. Mm-hmm. And so I've really appreciated anthropological perspectives, certainly in my research, and I'm sure others too. And I know that quite a few PhD students are now sort of starting to incorporate ethnographic methods as part of a sort of qualitative or even mixed method study. One of my questions was about sort of reading anthropology. So often in the biomedical literature, everything's sort of very delineated, sort of, you know, when you're reading a paper, it's, you know, the methods, the findings, it's all sort of very separated out. And if we're synthesizing data from anthropological studies as well, when you read them, they're not quite so clearly set out, you know, exactly how the participants were sampled and exactly who participated and, you know. So some of the tools that we use to synthesize evidence, like CASP or some of the other things, they want you to sort of be able to tick off certain criteria. Does the paper, you know, explain exactly how participants recruited, etc.? And one of the things I found hard is to be able to do that with anthropological papers. Could you offer us any sort of insight into how we can read, how we can use those papers in our work? That's maybe a, I don't know if it's a clear question, but
I think I think one of the issues is that, in terms of, you know, these specific structures and categories, anthropology really, or sort of standardizations and categories, anthropology, particularly sort of after this sort of postmodern turn, has really rejected those as, you know, as being seen as, you know, producing knowledge in a certain way. And so obviously, you know, I think, you know, in terms of the writing is always, the writing is sort of supposed to be, you know, responding more to, you know, what's happened in the field and the way that, you know, people are experiencing, you know, their lives every single day. And sometimes that can take different shapes that are not necessarily easily to categorize. This is something, you know, I've definitely struggled with too as well, when I was doing research, you know, my PhD on decision making and basically arguing that decision making is not this like logical, rational, linear process. But then obviously I had to write about that in a logical, linear fashion that, you know, made some sort of sense. But, you know, it's, yeah, I guess in terms of using it, so that's first of all, I think that's why anthropologists don't necessarily, depending on where you're reading and where you're publishing, obviously all the journals have different things that they require. In anthropology journals, you can obviously get away with being a little bit more looser because they'll understand that, you know, that is the way, you know, that things are done. But like, you know, there's an acceptance of that, you know, there's this sort of acceptance of, you know, things being a bit more literary and poetic too as well. In terms of then sort of using that, so was the question using that within work or citing it or sort of responding to it?
Particularly I was thinking if we're synthesizing evidence, for example, when I did my evidence synthesis, I had to exclude some some anthropological studies because they didn't exactly fit my criteria, my inclusion criteria, which is a real shame.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the framework that you're using. I mean, you know, it can depend, like, you know, you can have anthropological research that is a little bit more, you know, I guess like organized the way we would think about it, and then it's easier. But in general, because it's sort of, I think it resists that categorization and sort of resists those frameworks, particularly when you're doing a literature, particularly if you're doing like a systematic review, it can be very difficult. But that is, I think some anthropologists would say that's great, you know? I'm sorry, I don't know if I have a clear sort of answer there, because obviously it really does depend so much on, you know, which piece of literature, you know, which article or which book you're looking at. So yeah, sorry, Esther. Don't know if that was particularly helpful.
No, that is great, actually, just to sort of understand a bit more and sort of the way that anthropology is written. So thank you. We've got a couple more questions. I'm conscious of time, so let's try and get through as many as we can. So Anna says, anthropology as a discipline is a great tool to understanding health inequalities in maternal and child health from the perspectives of the lives of marginalized groups. How do you think we can use the rich stories that anthropology provides to impact policy, healthcare? So that maybe ties into the previous
I think this is such a great question, Anna. Thank you. This is really, I think, also first related to, you know, how anthropology is interacting outside of their own anthropological community. And, you know, I know a lot of medical anthropologists are more applied and are working interdisciplinarily. And just making that sort of more of a commonality within anthropology and not something that's so, and not such an insular discipline, I think is really, really important. At the same time, you know, I think in terms of, I think anthropology is maybe perhaps a little bit misunderstood, probably not because of anyone else's fault, probably because of anthropologists' fault, to be honest, because, you know, we can be very inclusive, the writing can be difficult to access, and that I think that there is sometimes a misunderstanding about the type of knowledge and type of the value of the knowledge that, you know, anthropology produces, particularly, like you were saying, you know, the rich, you know, the rich narratives and the rich stories of people's lives. And there's also, I think this is also related to, you know, the devaluation as well of qualitative research in general, you know, as not being able to be standardized and categorized, which I think really makes it stronger, particularly when you're looking, you know, particularly when you're thinking about issues about maternal and child health and disparities there. So I think it's, you know, having these conversations and, you know, dissemination is really important, you know, outreach, like something like, you know, hopefully what I'm doing right now. And also, you know, visibility is really important. And, you know, thinking about, you know, how we communicate our research too, as well. Obviously, you know, we don't want to water any of these things down, because it's really important that, you know, these stories and these experiences are really kept true to what's going on. But also, you know, there's obviously public health policy work being a system and something that, you know, we could probably, a structure within itself that has ways of doing things. You know, how do we understand those? What are those ways of doing things? How can we work with them? So I hope that answers your question, Anna. But yeah, I think that's a really important one, and something that, you know, I hope that we work on more, definitely.
Thank you. And just to say, we're going to be finishing in about 10 minutes, so do post those last few questions. So somebody, I can't quite see the name, said, could you recommend a good text about ethnography or example of ethnography that would be useful as a reminder or give understanding of the methodology of ethnography?
I've got some... got some references up. A basic sort of text on ethnography. I mean, I am sort of like thinking about ethnography a bit more. I mean, it's not that I don't think about it, but, you know, engaging with it a little bit more before this talk. I really did find Fabian's article on presence and representation and the other in anthropology really interesting. It's more about writing, but obviously it's really interconnected within ethnography. So I just really thought that text was really interesting. Also, I mean, obviously it depends on what kind of ethnography that you're doing. I mean, for me, I also had ethnography as participant listening too as well on there. And I think that was a really interesting text too as well, in terms of helping me sort of think about things, think about my work, think about my ethnography. And a more general text. Yeah. I mean, those are just things that I have there listed, and they were helpful for me. Yeah, I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you so much. I had another question. I think if I've missed anything in the chat, any of your questions in the chat, please do just quickly repost and I'll pick it up. But I think we've covered most of them so far. I had a question just about hanging out when doing ethnography and how that fits with getting consent. I've often wondered how, you know, whether in health research we have the form and we have people sign the form, and how consent works when in the kind of context of hanging out with potential participants.
Initially, obviously, before all the GDPR type of stuff, and I think obviously very important, information governance and ethical frameworks that we have. In anthropology, particularly doing ethnographic, research, particularly participant observation, consent was always something that is seen as negotiated. And, it was something that, you initially go in. not always was a written document too as well, because there are, sometimes you'll be going into communities, particularly, a political group, for instance, that, will not be, will not want to sign something. When you have situations like this, and this is every situation, this is not just the one I just mentioned, but, it's really important that the consent is negotiated. It's not just for bringing up that form and saying, I'm doing X, Y, Z, and then, you do it. It's sort of, checking in with people and saying, like, is this still okay? And that was, framework ethically, maybe not fully formalized or, documented, that anthropologists, were working in. That obviously doesn't necessarily mesh with, how research is expected to do, or what we're expected to do as researchers nowadays. I do think it's really important that anthropologists are, of course, obviously following these ethical frameworks, but, are making sure that, they are working within them in a really sort of rigorous way, given, the history of anthropology and doing ethnographic work and how much, was not given ethics approval initially. The way that, some of the controversies that people have had with, doing their research, bringing it back, publishing the work, and then people they did the research with just being very upset by what was written. And so, you're supposed to have these processes that, of this negotiation and this communication and this transparency and this trust. I think that this is sort of sometimes at odds with the sort of formal documentation. So much of this is changing, and I think we're still kind of working out the best way that we can do field work and do research, particularly when something unexpected happens or something unexpected emerges, or, a conversation happens that's, without the, with, you know, outside of the remit of what you're doing, you know, particularly when you're doing this participant observation and this hanging out, you know, it's very hard to just at every single instance, just being like with your sign up, just being like observation in progress, you know, and also thinking about, you know, how that changes the relationships within the space that you're working in. You know, when I was doing my participant observation, I did have to have a sign up that said, you know, observation in progress, you know, it had to be documented, you know, everything, you know, all the forms and stuff. And that can be, that can sort of break up the harmony of when you're just hanging out. It is a hard one. And, you know, I think anthropology doesn't necessarily mesh very well with some of the current frameworks that we have in place, but yeah.
Thank you. We've got the last two questions here. Joe says, are you hoping to share your PhD research as a traditional monograph?
I don't know. Probably not, because there's loads of things in there that, you know, happened along the way of the PhD journey that I don't know if anyone would be interested in reading. I'd love to eventually write a monograph up, but yeah, at the moment, no plans. That's apparent. I follow a lot of people on Twitter who are publishing monographs, and it seems like it's a process. It's a journey within itself. So,
Thank you. And I've certainly really appreciated looking more at visual anthropology to communicate research and disseminate research, which I think is such I think we can utilize so much more of in midwifery. It's something we haven't really done much of, but I think it'd be
I was just thinking, you know, in terms of the monograph too as well, and publishing the book, you know, how is that, you know, essentially, particularly if the book is not open access. You know, I've mentioned Rochelle Chadwick has been really great with her book, you know, making it available to PhD researchers and early career researchers, by the way, to students. If you email her, she did that for me when I was a student, email me a PDF of her book. But yeah, you know, those monographs can be really, really expensive and hard to access. And so, you know, that's another thing about, you know, this sort of how we are disseminating and communicating our research, you know, what kind of, and this is the same thing with academic journals too, as well, that are behind paywalls, you know, it's the same issue.
Thank you. And last question, I think probably for today, from Anna, do you have any recommendations for relevant medical anthropology journals for maternal and child health, or any associations or societies?
Yeah, so I don't know if there's a medical anthropology journal specifically for maternal and child health. I think always best, you know, going towards, you know, medical anthropology and medical anthropology quarterly, which I'm sure you already have looked at, Anna. As well, associations and societies. I did join, what is it called? I think it's called CAR, which is, I can't remember if it's what it stands for, something for reproductive anthropology mailing list. And I know there's like sort of a loosely formed sort of anthropology reproduction network, as well as, you know, anthropology for probably more for assisted reproductive technologies and things like that in the US. I know that they're really strong in terms of their societies in the US, but I haven't found any, you know, actually I was just joining that mailing list that and I'll send it to you, Anna, by the way, when I figure out the name of it. I always find that, you know, the maternal and child health stuff is really sort of, you know, it's sort of in between two things, you know, it's medical anthropology, but then it's also sometimes, you know, feminist anthropology, but then sometimes it's, you know, science and technology studies too as well. So, you know, it obviously bridges a lot of different things. So, as you all know, as midwives, I'm sure.
Thank you for that. And we're going to wrap up now. So I just want to say thank you again so, so much for taking the time this afternoon. I know from the comments, it's been very much appreciated. And we've really valued all your sort of your insights and answering the spontaneous questions so well. So thank you everyone for coming. Please do, let's carry on the conversation on Twitter. Use the hashtag PhD Midwives and you'll see all of our Twitter handles there as well. So thank you once again. And we'll be having our next meetup next month. We'll be posting more details on our Twitter handle. So have a good afternoon, everyone. And thanks again, Cassandra.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.